Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. If we accept the old adage, you are what you eat, then Michael Pollan has some unsettling news. Americans are mostly processed corn that walks. That's one of his conclusions in his new book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals. Another is that America has a national eating disorder, thanks mostly to the destruction of its food culture at the hands of industrialized agriculture. Pesticides, fertilizers, and misguided public policies have filled our supermarkets and dinner tables with food products at the expense of real food. But as he searches for the origins of what we eat, he also finds examples of sustainable agriculture, happy chickens, and grass-fed beef to warm the heart and fill the belly of any hungry omnivore. Up next on Point, Michael Pollan tells us what's for dinner. And joining me now from Seattle is Michael Pollan, author of the new book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals. Michael Pollan is a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine and professor of journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. He's also the author of the best-selling book, The Botany of Desire. And Michael Pollan, welcome.
Thanks, Anthony. Good to be here.
Yeah, it's great. It's great to have you. I really enjoyed your book. It's a real pleasure.
I appreciate that.
Lots of nice ideas in it, and really wonderfully written. You took quite a journey there.
Yeah, it was a great adventure, actually. It was some of the most satisfying reporting I've ever done.
Well, that's great to hear. You explore the origins of four meals, as we mentioned, and as we go through this hour, I'd like to check in on each of those meals. But before we talk about what you learned and your conclusions. But first, at the very beginning of the book, you talk about our nation as suffering from a national eating disorder. What's going on? What's the source of our disorder?
Well, first, the symptoms of our disorder is, you know, we are a culture obsessed with eating healthily that is very unhealthy.
Hmm.
We're a culture that's really kind of lost its way in trying to figure out what is, you know, one of the most basic human activities, basic animal activities, which is finding a nutritious meal for yourself and eating it. We really don't know what to eat. And what drove this home to me and made me realize what was going on was that wild episode a couple of years ago when the Atkins craze took off.
Mm.
And there were, when a single article in the New York Times Magazine, not by me, thank God, that said, in fact, it's not fat that makes you fat; it's carbs that makes you fat. And we had this overnight. We changed the American way of eating. Donut companies were bankrupted, bread stocks collapsed. You could not get a crust of bread at a dinner party.
No more pasta. Yeah.
No more pasta. Pasta was regarded as a toxic substance, and it still is in some quarters. And that said to me, boy, this is a very confused culture. Cultures do not change their diet overnight based on a single magazine article or a dietary fad, except this one. And it made me curious to know, because I really like bread and pasta.
I'm with you. And I couldn't imagine an article like that having that kind of impact, say, in Italy, for example.
Exactly. In a country with a stable food culture, and when I say food culture, it's kind of a very, you know, fancy way to say, you know, where culture is your mom. I mean, it's your mom, basically. You know, mothers carry these traditions down over the generations, and those traditions involve what you should eat, how you should eat it, this culture steadies us in our eating habits, and clearly, mom's hold over the dinner menu and our own innate wisdom about what we should and shouldn't eat has been lost in this fog of scientific information and misinformation and marketing.
Yeah.
That's a huge part of it. You know, we really get these $36 billion of messages trying to change the way we eat, and that's a very powerful force.
Well, where was the big turning point? I mean, did we ever know how to eat in this country, and when did we lose our way?
Well, you know, if you look at it historically, we have never had a very strong single food culture. I mean, there have been, you know, we're a nation of immigrants, and each immigrant population does have its own food culture, but nationally, none has kind of dominated. And what we saw with that carbophobia spasm a couple years ago. You know, if you look at the history, that was happening 100 years ago, too. John Harvey Kellogg and Fletcher, you know, there were these other wild fads. You know, people would pay to go to Kellogg, who invented the cereal, by the way, his sanitarium, and they would pay huge amounts of money to get enemas every hour and eat, you know, diets completely consisting of grapes or yogurt. And there was another huge trend that said the key to health was chewing your food every bite 100 times. It was called Fletcherizing.
I think I remember that. I think we were told that when we were kids.
Yeah, it was, well, we were told, but, you know, the 100 had come down to 20. So I think we've been prone to food fadism and to this sense that there were good nutrients and evil nutrients, and that the landscape consisted of these, you know, Scylla and Charybdis when you're eating. And anxiety has infected our eating in this country for a very long time. And we've pretended to be scientific eaters, although the scientific advice seems to keep changing. So I don't know that we've ever had the sort of food culture that the French have or the Italian have or many other cultures have. And I think that that's part of our problem. Mm. I think that makes us really vulnerable to marketing messages, to the latest scientific finding, to food fads. And so, you know, if you look at our history, it's this history of elevating one nutrient as, you know, the really important one, whether it's vitamins or now it's omega-3. We're putting omega-3 right in everything. And then there's the evil nutrient. And now that is trans fats or high fructose corn syrup.
Yeah.
And we seem to have this, you know, Manichaean battle between the good nutrient and the evil nutrient in our heads. And meanwhile, pleasure disappears.
Yeah.
And that really is the biggest shame, and the health effects of eating this way.
Well, you mentioned high fructose corn syrup, and that, of course, is all comes from one of the big boogeymen at the beginning of your book. And I'm wondering if you're being stalked by the Jolly Green Giant after publishing this book. Because you
I have heard from the Corn Refiners Association. They're very upset.
I'm sure. Well, let's spell that out a little bit, because you really have it in for corn, and so much of what we eat, you discovered on your journey, all ends up at a cornfield out in Iowa.
Yeah, you know, every section of this book, each of the food chains that I looked at, and I did organize the book by food chain, had some big surprises for me. And when I looked at the industrial food chain, which is to say the food most of us eat most of the time, whether it's in a fast food restaurant or supermarket food, when you trace that back to the earth, and of course all our food does begin in the earth as much as we've forgotten it. Even a Twinkie begins with some plant or animal somewhere. And we're not yet synthesizing food directly from chemicals and petroleum, although we're on our way. Mm. I ended up in the same place. I ended up in a cornfield in Iowa, essentially. Much of what we eat, you know, most of what we eat is carbon. Essentially, that's what we're doing. We're the right carbon life form, and we take carbon that originally was part of the air, carbon dioxide, fixed as a carbohydrate molecule by a plant, and then we either eat those plants or we eat the animals that eat those plants. Well, if you trace that carbon back, and remarkably, you can do it scientifically, you will find that it started in a cornfield or a soybean field. Soy takes turns with corn. Okay. If you are what we eat, what we are is corn. We are the people of corn. We're probably the corniest people on the planet, by which I mean more of our substance, our bodies, was formed by that plant than anything else. And I had no idea of the extent of it. I had no idea how many products in the supermarket consisted of corn.
Well, I wonder, Michael, you have a copy of your book out there. Can you read just a little bit? Because there's a passage that early on, it's on page 19, it's the sentence that begins, "Corn is in the coffee whitener." And just read down about halfway down.
Just so you know, this is part of a 500-word passage. So these examples are just the tip of the iceberg. "Corn is in the coffee whitener and cheese whiz, the frozen yogurt and TV dinner, the canned fruit and ketchup and candies, the soup and snacks and cake mixes, the frosting and gravy and frozen waffles, the syrups and hot sauces, the mayonnaise and mustard, the hot dogs and the bologna, the margarine and shortening, the salad dressing and the relishes and even the vitamins. Yes, it's in the Twinkie too. There are some 45,000 items in the average American supermarket, and more than a quarter of them now contain corn."
And you
that number is actually a lot higher.
Really? You conclude saying, so that's us, processed corn, walking.
That's us. And, you know, the Mexicans have always called themselves the people of corn, and they have this very healthy reverence, I think, for their dependence on a plant, corn, mm-hmm. which is the staple of their diet. But as it turns out, as I looked into it, we are more the people of corn than the Mexicans. Mm-hmm. We just don't realize it because our corn has been passed through either a processing to be turned into high fructose corn syrup or starch, or it has been passed through the gut of animals and turned into meat. And the Mexicans, by comparison, although they eat a lot of corn in their tortillas and tamales, they still fatten their animals on grass rather than corn, mm. and they still sweeten their soft drinks with sugar rather than corn syrup.
So we are the real, and we should be.
There, you know, the Aztecs' worship of corn was the beta test of our worship of corn. We just don't have much self-consciousness about it.
What's wrong with that? Why this problem with corn invading our diet in this way?
Well, it's a very good question. Why should we worry? And there are a couple reasons, and they both have to do with the idea of monoculture, too much of one thing. Mm. You know, one of the great lessons of nature is you'd never put all your eggs in one basket. The Irish learned this in 1845. They were the people of potatoes the way we're the people of corn. And when the potato crop failed, which it did in 1845, a million Irish died. You just shouldn't put all your eggs in one basket. It's a dangerous way to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know that we're in danger of the corn crop completely failing, although, you know, it's such a monoculture that it's vulnerable and needs a great amount of chemicals to keep it going. So from an environmental point of view, it's a mistake to plant that much of your land with the same crop. And the results are groundwater pollution in the Midwest, the dead zone in the Gulf, which is essentially caused by all the fertilizer put on corn fields washing down the Mississippi. It's kind of the Gulf has become the sort of toilet bowl of corn, and it's the size of New Jersey. It's a place where no life exists. So there's an environmental problem, but there's a health problem for us too. And it's not to say that these are dangerous products per se, or that high fructose corn syrup is going to hurt you, but when you're eating so much processed food, because the way we eat corn is not really as food, but as food products, you're not getting the variety of nutrients you need. You know, we're generalist species. We are omnivores. We need about 50 different nutrients of one kind or another, minerals, amino acids, plant chemicals. And if you eat one plant, you're not getting them. And especially if that plant has been highly processed. So we have a situation now. I live in Oakland, California, where there are overweight kids who live on a diet of fast food who actually have the diseases of undernutrition. They come into clinics with things like rickets, which we thought were banished a long time ago. And the reason is that they're eating a diet that is so highly processed, so corn-based, that they're not getting the vitamin D they need. They're not getting the other vitamins they need. So they're coming down with these nutrient deficiencies that we thought were gone. And the idea you could be overfed and undernourished is a kind of a shocking idea. We didn't realize this was possible.
Wow.
I think that's coming from this monoculture diet.
Right. And when you analyze, speaking of the fast food diet, and this was the first meal that you analyze, you look at a lunch at McDonald's. Tell me about that. How much corn did it have in it? I mean, it's not that you had corn on the cob. There's something else going on there. Right?
There was nothing. There was no corn on the menu, but it was all corn. There's something like 45 menu items at McDonald's that consist in large part of corn. You know, when you eat that, I actually ran that McDonald's meal through a machine on campus at Berkeley where I teach, a mass spectrometer, because it turns out you can identify all that carbon and figure out where it comes from. And just to give you some examples, the soda was 100% corn. You know, you don't count the water, but the solids in it, the all sugar. The salad dressing was something like 70% corn. This is the Paul Newman salad dressing. It has a lot of high fructose corn syrup and corn oil in it. Even the French fries were 23% corn. Now, how does that work? How can a French fry be corn? Well, because the oil, which is where most of the calories come from, the oil on any given day can be corn oil. The burger, the cheeseburger, was 56% corn. The chicken nugget was even more than that. So I was shocked that, you know, we ate several bushels of corn for lunch that day, and We ate it in the car, where, by the way, Americans now eat 19% of their meals. And so we were racing down Highway 101, and our car was eating corn as well, because now we feed our cars corn in the form of ethanol. I mean, this plant is taking over. This is the plant that ate America. It is, you know, taking over. Now that it's filled us up, it's trying to fill our cars up.
And you write it, it consumes fossil fuel because fertilizers are made from fossil fuels.
Well, that's another tremendous problem with, and I'm glad you brought that up, with eating this way. And that is, this is a very energy-intensive way to eat. To grow all that corn, which is one of the greediest plants, it really is the SUV of plants. It sucks up so much nitrogen fertilizer. That nitrogen fertilizer is made from fossil fuel. To turn that corn into processed foods, such as high fructose corn syrup, takes an enormous amount of fossil fuel. It's a high heat, high energy process. And then to take that food and ship it all around the country, because this is a national food system, it's not a local food system, takes another layer of energy, with the result that we are using, I don't think people realize that, but about 20% of our fossil fuel use in this country is going to feed ourselves. And that's more than we spend on personal transportation.
Mm-hmm.
So this is from a if you you care about global warming, if you care about our energy dependence in the Middle East, you have to realize that the food issue is your issue, because eating this way takes way too much fossil fuel, and that has to do with processing a plant like corn.
Right. Now, this takes us to meal number two, which is organic foods. You put together a meal from the Whole Foods supermarket. How does that work? Whole Foods supermarket is a big business now. Can you go in there and find good food that isn't consuming fossil fuel and that isn't, mostly corn and that isn't going to give kids rickets and so on and so forth?
Well, you know, yes and no. You can find some excellent food in Whole Foods. I'm, kind of a sucker for Whole Foods. I love I love their marketing. I think they're wonderful storytellers.
In fact, you talk about it as storied food, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think that our attraction to stores like Whole Foods, which is the most successful supermarket chain in terms of growth right now, has to do with the fact that we are looking for food that will tell us some stories about where it came from, because the food in the supermarket or in the fast food outlet is so silent. It's so opaque about its origins. And people do want to reconnect to nature through their eating, and that's a very healthy desire, and Whole Foods is satisfying that desire. You can find, organic food that was not grown with fossil fuel fertilizer there, and that's very important. You can find food that was grown without pesticides, also very important, from coming from farms that take much better care of the land. That said, though, there's a lot of other products there that are not organic, and there is a lot of organic food that is soaked in fossil fuel, not because of the way it was grown, but where it was grown. If you look at your Whole Foods, check it out and look where the food is coming from. You will find that most of the produce is coming from California. And a lot of it is coming from Mexico and South America. Whole Foods, my Whole Foods in Berkeley, Whole Foods I visited in New York the other day, had grass-fed beef, which is a wonderful thing to see. I think it's a really important contribution to solving our problems about food. But it had come from New Zealand. And across the street in the farmer's market, there was grass-fed beef from the Hudson Valley. Why are we shipping beef all the way from New Zealand? If you care about the environment, that is not a sustainable thing to be doing. So Whole Foods is part of the global marketplace. And it is, they pay lip service to local food, but if you look in the stores, you're hard-pressed to find any. So again, technically you can have organic asparagus from Argentina in the middle of the winter and call it organic, and that's legal. But in any deeper, meaningful sense of the word, is that really organic?
Let's take a couple of calls. Harry is calling from Amherst, New York. Hi, Harry.
Yes, I'd just like to say that we weren't too badly off in this country during the Second World War, but towards the end of the war, the sugar supply sort of ran out for the civilians at any rate, and the first substitute was corn syrup, and we had a relative working at A. E. Staley's plant in Boston, and in some way he'd bring home some cans of this, And it certainly didn't appeal to me after having been brought up on cane sugar. But the second thing is I want to say that I'm absolutely astonished at the, for someone who's lived as long as I have, at the destruction of the American food supply in the last 30 years, and particularly in the last 8 years under the Clinton and Bush administrations. Mm. And I was wondering if Mr. Pollan would have any suggestion or idea as to how the destruction of the food supply can be reversed so that we'll once again have real food in this country.
Harry, thanks for the call. Well, it's a great question.
It's a great question.
Michael, do you put it that strongly, though? Has the food supply been destroyed?
I wouldn't say it's been destroyed. I mean, look, we've got more food than any culture's ever had. And, and you know, these are problems of abundance, which, you know, we must remind ourselves are better than problems of starvation.
But you take the sense of what
absolutely.
Harry is saying. Yeah.
Look, the way we eat has changed more since World War II in the last 50 years than probably it had changed in the 5,000 years before that. We have reinvented our food supply. There are, foods in the supermarket that your great-grandmother would not know what to do with. You know, where do you put the Go-Gurt? What is that? How do you administer that product? The Pop-Tart. Goo, this new kind of pure fuel that's being sold to athletes, which is, you know, corn, by the way. Mm-hmm. So we've replaced food, as you said in your intro, with food products. And, how do you reverse this? Well, any consumer can reverse it. I mean, this is one of those few issues in our lives where we have immense amount of power. We decide every day what to put into our bodies. I paid taxes early this week, and I'm sure that everyone in your audience knows about something our government is using that tax money for that they find truly deplorable, whatever your politics. And you can't do anything about it unless you're willing to go to jail and practice civil disobedience. You can withdraw from a food chain you don't support. You can withdraw your support from pig factories that are immiserating, pigs. You have a vote here. And so the first thing is to, withdraw your support for that food supply. Stay out of McDonald's. If you're concerned about what's happened to our food supply, one nice rule of thumb is don't eat anything that your ancestors wouldn't have recognized as food.
But Michael,
think back to your great grandmother. Would she know what that stuff is?
And, right.
If she wouldn't, well, maybe you want to stay away from it until it's really been tested on the larger population.
If you can't say what food it is, maybe you shouldn't eat it. But Michael, let me just sort of push back a little bit there, and that is, I see this having a lot to do with people's personal economies. I mean, if you look at the way people shop in supermarkets, they'll gravitate toward processed foods because they're cheaper. I mean, to go and get a big brown paper bag full of organic produce from Whole Foods is a wonderful thing to do, and I'm sure you do it. I've done it. But not everybody can afford that.
Well, there is that, and you raise a very important issue, which is eating well in this country costs more than eating poorly. We have a system in which the cheapest calories in the supermarket, which is to say the calories in that great middle, you know, you've got kind of the fresher foods around the edges, and in the middle is all the processed food, the corn, basically, is in the middle. Those calories are the cheap calories. If this has been studied. If you have a dollar to spend, and say you're somebody without a lot of money, and you are shopping for energy for your family, you're shopping for calories, and you've got a dollar to spend. If you go to the middle of the snack aisles, you can get something like 1,800 calories for a dollar. But if you go to the produce aisle, you can only get 250 calories of carrots. Mm-hmm. Why is that? Well, because we're subsidizing the food in the middle of the store. We're subsidizing the corn-based calories. We're subsidizing the high fructose corn syrup. We cut a check to farmers for every bushel of corn they can grow. We're not doing that with the produce. So it's the way the game is being played. But the game could be played in a different way. We could have different farm policies that would make corn a little less cheap and produce a little cheaper. And suddenly you would have a situation where people could afford to eat more healthily. Eating badly is a very rational thing to do in this country because of the rules that we've organized the game around.
I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. Let's go back to a caller. Debbie is calling from Garber, Iowa. Corn Country, Debbie. Welcome.
Well, hi. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for calling.
I'd like to push back a little bit on a couple of things that the author said.
Okay.
One of the things is a common assumption that the fertilizer going down into the Gulf of Mexico that is creating the dead zone is from the farms. And I say there's been studies been done that there are a lot of city storm sewers that empty everybody's lawn fertilizers down into the waterways. And there have been some facts about that. You know, as a farmer, fertilizer is really expensive. So we test our fields, and we also fatten cattle. So we spread manure, which is a byproduct of that. And we are very cautious. We have our water tested that comes out of the fields, and it is not nitrogen-rich. You know, even sewer systems, if you have a leaking septic tank, that is people nitrogen.
Hmm.
So I think that's an assumption that really shouldn't be thrown out there lightly.
Debbie, let me just to clarify, you said you're a farmer in Iowa. Are you a corn farmer?
Yes.
Michael, do you want to respond to
Debbie? Yeah, sure,
I'd
be happy to.
Yeah, go ahead.
It sounds to me like Debbie is farming more sustainably and using better practices than a lot of farmers that I interviewed. I talked to farmers who actually would tell me, you know, yeah, the agricultural extension tells me I should be using 100 pounds of nitrogen per acre. But I have to tell you, I put on 200 pounds because it's crop insurance. I mean, they're farmers who know they're putting on too much because until recently it wasn't that expensive. I mean, the price of fertilizer has gone way up. And, you know, the fact that Debbie is also still fattening cattle on the farm makes her farm quite unusual. Most of the animals have moved off the farm and the farm's been taken over. So she's got a form of fertility that isn't synthetic nitrogen, and that's terrific. But it's true that what we the way we treat our lawns is contributing to this problem, too. But most of the research I've read attributes the bulk of the nitrogen getting into the Mississippi to farms. There are other sources, no doubt. And if we had more farms like Debbie, it wouldn't be nearly as big a problem.
Debbie, thanks for the call. And Michael, before we get back to our conversation, I want to bring in another voice briefly into this conversation. He's joining us from Denver, Colorado. It's Tucker Shaw, dining critic for the Denver Post. He's the author of Everything I Ate, A Year in the Life of My Mouth, a book of photographs of every meal and snack he ate for 1 year. And Tucker Shaw, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great having you. What do you hear when you hear Michael Pollan and his thesis? As you look out across this vast landscape of food and dining in this country, what's the condition? What's the word out there?
Well, you know, I mean, a lot of it is very overwhelming, and there's a lot to think about when you're a consumer. I think one of the big problems, and I think it's something that he touched on a little bit earlier, was this sort of collective disconnect from what we're actually eating, and people on a personal level are not being honest with themselves and also just sort of not honest with the world about what they are taking in. I moved here about 6 months ago from New York, and it was quite a shock to see how many fewer choices we have in places like Denver.
Mm. When you say fewer choices, are you talking about restaurants? I know you're a dining critic. Are you talking about food in the markets? Or
that's sort of both.
We don't
have a tradition here in Denver or a very long tradition of smaller markets and smaller producers. We're starting to have more farmers markets and things like that here. But, for example, to go to a Whole Foods, there's a few of them peppered around the city, but you do have to get in the car and sort of drive to get there. And when you have to make the choice between, you know, heading over to Safeway and picking up whatever they have versus going to Whole Foods and picking up a nice piece of grass-fed beef, the overhead in making that decision is sometimes bigger than just, you know, what's coming out of your pocket
right
when you're at the till.
Michael Pollan, do you see regional differences? I mean, your book, and we're going to get back to that, but, you know, you have a lot of recipes and ideas and suggestions about how to live. Is it harder to do in certain parts of the country than others?
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, there are places right now I live in a place where it's very easy to eat well in Northern California. But I come from a place where it wasn't. I used to live in New England and in rural Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And the key for me was getting a big freezer and keeping it in the basement. And so when I ran into a farmer who was doing really great chickens or beef, you know, I could buy a lot of it and store it. But there's no question what Tucker says is it takes a little more work. You have to be, you know, you have to give up the instant gratification of getting anything you want, anytime you want. You know, eating seasonally and incurring that overhead, as he put it. I think it's absolutely true. But I also think that it's not necessarily such a burden. I mean, I think procuring and preparing our foods is one of the great pleasures of my life. You know, I think we've been a little bit brainwashed into this cult of convenience. You know, the getting of food is something we were hardwired to do. Putting a little bit more time into it seems to me is something to cultivate.
But when you say this cult of convenience, you mean we've sort of been brainwashed into thinking that cooking is drudgery. It's drudgery. It's too much time. I've got the kids. I've got this. I've got that. I can't, you know, I don't have, who has time to cook dinner?
Yeah. And, you know, I don't buy it. I mean, you know, cooking doesn't take 3 hours. I put dinner on the table almost every night, and you can make a perfectly good meal in 20 minutes. Granted, it's easier if you've got good ingredients at hand. You know, the food industry had to work very hard to persuade the American woman in the 1950s that cooking was a burden. Women liked to cook. They felt very fulfilled feeding their family. Not to mention men, and increasingly men. I mean, cooking was a very gendered activity, and the loss of home ec, I think, was kind of a small tragedy in America, you know, and we got rid of it because of feminism and because it was so gendered. But I think it's coming back into the schools, and I think that's a very healthy thing. And boys today don't realize that cooking is something that's, you know, supposed mm-hmm. to be for girls. I mean, they see chefs who are male. There are many role models who are male cooking. I think a big part of the solution is getting kids to learn about food in school, to figure out where their food comes from, to grow it and to prepare it and realize what a pleasure it is to cook a meal.
Mm. Tucker Shaw, before we let you go in this context of good food and eating healthfully, what's the best restaurant you've been to lately and maybe one of the worst?
Well, you know, Denver's got a lot of really good. There's a very strong tradition here of eating organically and stuff like that. And there are restaurants now. There's a wonderful restaurant in Boulder called The Kitchen where they even attach provenance to their water and tell you exactly where it comes from and offer it to you complimentary.
It doesn't come from Colorado?
It comes from El Dorado Springs, which is in Colorado.
I see, okay.
But they do like to attach that story to it. However, you know, the way that suburbs are cropping up in Denver and also in other cities, the choices are shockingly limited. You can't even find a little guy who's just running his own little restaurant without a whole lot of work and a whole lot of, you know, burning a lot of gas in your car to get there. Unfortunately, the strip malls are what rules. And
mm-hmm.
you've got, you know, the Fazoli's and the Outbacks and these places that, as Michael says, are pretty much serving corn.
Tucker Shaw, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate you having with us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Tucker Shaw. He's the dining critic for the Denver Post, author of Everything I Ate, A Year in the Life of My Mouth. Let's take a couple of calls. Peg is calling from Boston. Hi, Peg.
Hi there. I think this is a wonderful and important conversation.
Thank you.
I'm a big fan of Michael Pollan, and I often recommend his book, The Botany of Desire, to my creative writing students, just as such a great example of inspiration from the everyday. I'm very interested in this idea of a culture of food, because it seems to me that an awful lot of it has to do with the way that things have just changed so much in this country in recent years. The way that I was raised, my father hunted and fished a lot. Both my parents were avid gardeners. We grew a lot and procured a lot of what we ate. We also would go out into the country and pick nuts and fruit and stuff. And I really try to adhere to that sort of principle now. It's very difficult because I live in the city, but I can't even grow organic vegetables in my garden plot. I have a garden plot in the Fens, in the Victory Gardens, but there's so much pesticide use there, and the soil quality is so poor that I don't see the point of doing that. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's very interesting that there's this real interest now in eating really well, but that people have to spend a lot of money and go to a great deal of trouble to do it. I remember a few years ago, I took my niece and nephew apple picking, and we came home and we made a pie. And they were ecstatic because they had never done this before. And I thought that was a real tragedy because I must have done that 6 or 7 times every autumn when I was growing up.
Mm. Peg, thanks for the call. You raised some great issues that are consistent with this conversation. Are you finding it difficult, though, to adhere to those values that you say you miss?
I do find it difficult. Mm-hmm. You know, when I go visit my parents, my dad's always giving me vegetables from the garden and giving me venison from the freezer, which I think is delightful. And my friends always think it's a treat if I bring something over for dinner. You know, I'm about to move actually to New York State and hope to be growing organic vegetables in my yard, and that'll be really nice. But and Boston's a great place in terms of we do have all these wonderful, you know, Whole Foods and stores where you can buy organic produce. And we do have a wonderful farmers market system here. Mm-hmm. So for part of the year, you can grow more or less locally grown organic produce, but you know, it's still, I feel bad for people that live in areas that where they don't have this access.
Peg, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Michael Pollan, let me ask you about that organic thing that Peg raised, and that is, and this gets sort of, we'll wrap up the conversation about the Whole Foods thing, but that is, now that the government controls what organic means and big food businesses are cashing in on it, is the meaning of organic being lost?
I don't know if it's being lost, but it's certainly being diluted. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know that people realize, but we have organic feedlots now where, you know, a lot of our organic milk comes from. We have organic factory farms. These are words that, you know, I never thought we would be putting together.
So when you get a piece of organic beef, an organic corn-fed beef, these cows are still sitting in huge feedlots that are essentially, you know, big lots of their own manure that they live and die in.
And they're eating corn,
right.
You know, which they're not evolved to eat. They should be eating grass. I actually think getting grass-finished beef is more important than getting organic beef. I mean, for the cow, eating organic corn, I mean, it's sort of a joke because the corn makes them sick. The fact that it doesn't have any pesticides in it doesn't make it any better. I think, you know, one of the important choices that many of us have to face now is, do you buy organic or local? And, you know, listening to your last caller, local supports a great many other values besides no pesticide in a farm in California. And what you really want to support is that local apple orchard where she took her niece and nephew to buy apples. That orchard is going to go out and be turned into housing development unless people nearby buy those apples and don't buy the Washington State apples. You know, we need to, if we're going to put our food culture back on a good footing, we need farms around us, and these farms are going to fail unless we patronize them. Mm. So when you support local agriculture, it's an act of land conservation as well. It's a check on sprawl. And this is the generation we have to do it, because if we don't save these farms now by patronizing them, our children will not have that experience of going to an orchard or a farm stand, and the result will be an even more disconnected food culture. I'm worried that we're moving to a point where all our food will come from Mexico, and people will be so, you know, and we'll never be able to go back, because once that farmland is turned into housing developments, it will never be undone. And I think that would be a huge tragedy and a huge threat to our national security and to our personal health and happiness.
I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. Quick transition. I mean, this brings us to meal number three, because you found a great meal at a great farm, the Polyface Farm in Swope, Virginia. Tell us that story. This was an example of sustainable agriculture where the sun feeds the grass, the cows eat the grass, and we eat the cows.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot of good news in this book. And I mean, we've been painting a fairly dark portrait, but there's a lot of reason for hope. And when you go to a farm like this, for me, this was kind of the best news in the book, was that there are ways to grow food that actually improve nature. You know, we have in our heads this basic idea that for us to get what we want from the natural world, it's a zero-sum game, and that nature is less for it, is diminished by our extracting, you know, whether it's energy or entertainment or food. And when I saw this farm, which has it's called Polyface Farm, and they have a very elaborate rotation of different animals going over the same pastures at different times. And the result is if you graze beef cattle really well, you actually will increase the amount of soil, increase the biodiversity, increase the fertility. So at the end of the year, not only have you taken all this wonderfully nutritious and wholesome food off of it, but the land is better for it. It's been healed. And, you know, there it is, the free lunch. Mm. There is a free lunch. And the free lunch is solar energy passing through grasses passing through ruminants to us. And to me, you know, that's not just about food. That's a message of hope about our whole environmental predicament, that there are ways we can use nature without diminishing nature. And so I came out of that, you know, deeply moved. It was, you know, it was almost a spiritual experience to see how that works. And see also, by the way, animals, you know, living, you know, the kind of lives they were designed by their evolution to live. And by the way, being incredibly tasty.
Let's go to Brian, who's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Brian.
Hi. I have to give a full disclosure before I ask my question.
Okay.
I am a vegetarian, and I buy organic foods from big supermarkets and local stands regularly, but I have to kind of be a devil's advocate for an issue that was raised to me that I thought was really interesting. And it basically boils down to the idea that any organic farm could potentially be a traditional higher yield farm, and organic farms produce less produce at higher cost. And so how do you respond to the charge that are those who buy organic taking cheaper, more plentiful food out of the mouths of poorer people?
Wow.
Pesticides can be bad, but, you know, going hungry because you can only afford one carrot instead of two is even worse.
Okay, it's a great question. Well, let me put it to Michael Pollan.
It's a terrific question. I don't know that organic farms are taking food out of anybody's mouths. Organic farms right now are, when you do side-by-side comparisons, are 10 to 20% less productive. Because of pesticides and the amount of labor they take. However, that's not always true. In a drought year, they're actually more productive because their soil is so much healthier. It holds water better. You know, I think the real issue, what's taking food out of the mouths of hungry people is growing corn and feeding it to animals. You lose, when you pass that corn through those animals, you lose 90% of its food value, is just wasted. That's why, you know, Francis Moore LePay and other people have always argued we need to eat lower on the food chain. As a vegetarian, you're someone who is thinking more about your food than most people in this country, and I applaud that. You're making conscious choices. They're not my choices, but they're conscious, and really that's what we need to do, is simply be conscious about it. But organic food is not removing food from anybody's belly. The fact that it's more expensive troubles me. And
well, that's sort of the point, Brian's point, that I wanted to pick up with you, and that is,
yeah,
it is more expensive, and not everybody can afford it. And, you know, I feel like, well, in a way, this conversation is sort of, to a certain extent, directed, is a little elitist in that sense.
Well, let me address that point, because I think it's a very important point. There's a couple ways to answer it. One is, the price of organic food is and will continue to come down. Walmart is making a big push into organic. If anybody can force down the price of organic food, they will do it. I'm afraid they're going to crush many farmers in the process. But the price of organic will become more accessible. Second, one of the reasons organic is more expensive is the fact that our government doesn't help organic farmers at all. We only help industrial farmers growing things like corn and soybeans. So this is a matter of policy. This isn't the organic farmer's fault. This is the fact that our government has chosen to subsidize one kind of very unhealthy food and not another kind of food. We could change that. We could change that by changing policy. Last point I'd make about this is that there are 10% or so of the American people who can't afford to spend any more than they're already spending on food. There are a lot of us, however, and I'm not just talking about the middle class or the upper middle class, who can afford to spend more. We only spend 9% of our income on food. That's less than any people in history, less than any people in the world. It's down from 18% when I was a kid. For some reason, we resist spending more on food. We're happy to buy quality when it comes to clothing, when it comes to cars, but not food. So it's an issue of priority.
Priority. And that's where we're going to end it today. Michael Pollan, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in.
Great to be here, Anthony. Thanks a lot.
Congratulations on the book. It's a wonderful read. That's Michael Pollan, author of the new book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals. You can continue the conversation. Download the On Point podcast at onpointradio.org. Our senior producer is Joe O'Connor. I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point.